It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Janine Garofalo's favorite teabagging rednecks. Mark Gillar.
Welcome to the Tea Party Power Hour. I'm your host, Mark Gillar. What an incredible show we have for you today. In the second half of the hour, we're going to be visiting with Laura Schroff and Maurice Mazak about a book involving both of their lives called An Invisible Thread. It's the story of an 11-year-old panhandler on the streets of New York and a busy advertising executive who just happened to cross paths, and how that chance meeting changed the lives of so many people for the better. I think it's the feel-good book of this Christmas season, and I can't wait to let you talk to them. But first up, Maria Conchita Alonso, even her name sounds sexy, is going to be here to tell us about her chance meeting with Sean Penn in an airport and how she basically read Sean Penn the riot act regarding Hugo Chavez. It's a story that's all over the major networks. It's gone viral on the internet. But this is your chance to hear Maria discuss it at length in her own words. We're also going to send out a little challenge to Sean Penn before the interview's over, I think. So, please join us right after this message.
Hi, I'm Brian Brody. Have you ever lost your power and simply wanted to flip a switch to turn your lights back on? If so, this message is the most important you will ever hear, because there's never been a better time to get off the grid and generate your own supply of electrical power. Solar power generators are now available. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving electrical power when you need it most. Unlike gas generators, a solar generator runs quietly, emits no fumes, and produces electricity from the sun. It's like running an electric power plant in your own home. Hurricanes, ice storms, brownouts, blackouts, you'll never suffer through painful power outages again.
I want to remind my listeners, if you'd like to learn more about how you can have a solar-powered generator to protect your family in the event of a tornado, hurricane, or winter storm, just go to teapartypowerhour.com and click on one of the advertisements on the page. Solar power is clean, efficient, and you can't run out of it. So check them out at teapartypowerhour.com. Now, to my first guest, Maria Conchita Alonso. Did I come close to pronouncing that right?
That is correct.
Very good. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Miss Piggy talking to you.
Okay. I suspect you know why everyone wants to interview you right now.
Yeah, I know. It's very interesting that you know, Christmas Eve week, all this is happening. It's like crazy.
Absolutely. So you just happened to run into Sean Penn in an airport. And
yes.
This is a guy that you actually did a movie with, Colors. And you actually played a rather steamy love scene with Sean Penn, did you not?
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah, and you had to actually act like you were attracted to him. did you get an Academy Award for that? I mean, that must have been a hell of an acting job.
No, but you know what? Let me tell you. I mean, back then, he was very nice. We never spoke about any political. I mean, you know, Chavez didn't exist, and I didn't know that he liked Fidel Castro. You know, so there were no exchanges in anything, because we had no idea about each other's political views. So he was a quite nice guy. Believe it or not, at moments he was even shy.
Wow.
And we had good chemistry. That was, you know, back then.
I see. Well, so you're looking at you're going to pick up your luggage or something, and you look up and suddenly you recognize Sean Penn. Did you just go into autopilot at that point and go after
him?
Wow.
Well, you know, I went to pick up my mother, and my mother was in a wheelchair because of her age, you know, because she's sick, and the suitcase did not appear, so she was very, very worried. And the guy who handles the wheelchair for people, you know,
uh-huh.
All of a sudden, out of the blue, he says, "Oh, don't worry, if Champagne is calm, everything is okay." So I'm like, he's the one who saw it first. I'm like, what? What do you say? And then he says it again, and I'm like, where is he? And he shows him, you know, to me, he was on the other side of the carousel, you know, with the suitcases come out. on the other side. And I'm like, oh, my God, oh, my God. Because, you know, for a long time I've been wanting to talk to him. Mm-hmm. I mean, really not to fight, just to see why he believes that, you know, Chavez is good, or Chavez and you know, all his friends, and why does he like the Castro so much. So, but, you know, for a second I doubted, should I go over there or not? So I chose not to go. I didn't want to go all the way around where he was and all that stuff, so I chose not to go. I said, well, you know what, this, whatever. But then something happened, which, you know, the carousel stopped and the suitcase didn't come. So we went to the airline's lost and found office, and also his bags were not there. So when I'm there, you see, I mean, it was a very big coincidence that this happened, because, you know, we were right there, a few, like 10 meters away from each other. And I said, okay, now I have to go to him. I mean, this is like it's meant to be. So I walked towards him, very calm, you know. I am someone that knows that when you scream and when you're angry, neither party listens, you know. So it's a waste of time. There are ways of saying things without, you know, without insulting and screaming at people. I've learned that with age, because I didn't used to be when I was younger, it's like that. So I used to go to him, and you know, for a second, he didn't recognize me. I don't know if it was in purpose or not, but, you know, I did have big black glasses and a long coat covering my whole body, so I would not be, you know, recognized, whatever. But then right away he says, oh, it's you. And that's how the conversation started, which started, you know, soft. I mean, not angry, but firm. We were both, you know, firm. I just wanted to talk to him. Of course, not at the airport, because these issues, you don't talk in an open place and in 2 minutes.
Right.
I just wanted us to set a day for us to meet at an office or whatever, just to talk and exchange our points of view. I would show him facts. He could show me his, whatever, you know. But his reaction was, you know, that he had nothing to talk to me, because he was, you know, I'd been saying bad things about him. And I just said, no, I've been speaking the truth. I've been telling the truth. You know, how can you respect and admire Hugo Chavez? So then he started kind of like attacking me, not attacking me, but, you know, became very strong and said something, you know, well, your brother, whatever. And then, you know, that's when I say, well, your father, you know, was a communist. So you were raised like that. And then I said, you know, you are a communist, champagne. And then after that, you know, I said, how can you support your child? And I'm a Ahmadinejad. And he mentioned that he never, you know, has said that he has supported Ahmadinejad.
Mm-hmm.
And then he calls me a pig. And
by the way, you are a beautiful, beautiful woman, and Sean Penn was lucky to have played a love scene with you.
thank you. But, you know, I mean, I really was not expecting this to go the way it went. You know, when he calls me that, I just, it's amazing how many things you can think and go through your mind in just a couple of seconds,
yeah.
You know. It's incredible. So the first thing that I just came out of me, that came out of me was, and you are a communist deep hole.
Right.
You know, I mean, I just, you know, he tells me, he says, you know, you're harassing me. And I'm like, no, I'm not. You are the one who called me a pig. You know, I'm just, you know, calling you a communist deep hole. And I just, you know, I say, you know, it's great to leave the way, you know, you live being a communist, whatever, you know. I mean, I said that before. I mean, I'm, you know. So I just turned around and left towards my mother. But I was so angry, so, you know, with all this situation, with all this, that I hear that he said something a little bit loud, because as I was walking away, I have no idea what he said, no idea. I don't know if he said something nice or not, but I just then when I reached where my mother was, I just turned around and I said, and I repeat again, and you are a communist meatball, which is, you know, something I really regret saying that name, not communist, but, you know.
Thanks for explaining that.
I know, because, you know, I did lower myself. I think we don't need to get to those points of calling each other pig and this and that. And, you know, I mean, it's not civilized. But anyway, it happened. I'm sorry for the people that were there, which I think they were, like, in shock. But at the same time, it was a great movie for them to see there.
Well, how did the press find out about it? How did the press find out about it?
Well, I wrote it. I put it on my Twitter, and I put it on my Facebook. I'm like, oh my God, you don't know what just happened. Oh my God, this is what happened, and I just tell the whole story. And you know how nowadays Facebook and Twitter is, you know?
Yeah.
The bad thing about this is that. I did not get what I wanted to get, which was for us to meet. So I still won't be able to meet with him, and, you know, and for both of us to, you know, to see, you know, what he thinks he knows, you know. That's the bad thing of all of this, you know, and which I would love to have a debate with him.
Well, I'll call him up. I'm going to call his people. I've looked up his agent's name, and I'll ask him if he'll come on the Tea Party Power Hour and have a debate or, you know, a conversation with Maria Conchita Alonso, and we'll see what he says.
Yeah, you can do the same thing with Danny Glover and Oliver Stone.
Okay, sure.
They know that I've been wanting to talk to them, and they don't, you know. I mean, let me tell you something. If you are a communist or an extreme leftist, you know, and you really believe in that, and you really live your life as one of them, which is, you know, in a little apartment, you don't spend money in clothes or in jewelry, you know, you have a little car or you use the bus, you know, if you really believe that, I do have to respect you, even if I don't share it.
Mm-hmm.
That I have to. I mean, I do. It's like, wow, okay, great. This person is real, is honest. But if you preach that, you know, being rich is bad, you know, living in the United States is horrible, you know, spending money for clothes or jewelry or traveling first class is bad, then you travel in a private plane and you live in a meeting house, and then that's what I don't respect, you know?
Ah, so basically you're saying, in addition to being a beepole, Sean Penn's a hypocrite.
Well, I'm not really saying a hypocrite because I want to find out. That's something why I wanted to talk to him about. I want to find out exactly what is it that they have shown him, or that he believes in them so much. And you know, maybe he's very intelligent, so I don't know why he hasn't done homework into finding out, not from the voices of those dictators, but from himself, you know, to find out exactly what's going on. And I want to believe that a lot of, you know, nice, great Hollywood people, artists who like them, they are the same, you know. I mean, they maybe are confused. It's like they don't know that every day in Venezuela, which never happened before, the light goes off. Every day that there's no water. You know, these days there's not going to be water from this time to this time. You go to the pharmacies and you can't find medicine. You go to the supermarket and you can't find flour, milk, sugar. You know, you go to the hospitals and sometimes people come in and there's no place to put them and they are on the floor. I mean, it's a disaster. It's a disaster. What happens is that Chavez says, you know, I'm going to build 100,000 houses for the poor now. And he builds, I don't know, 25,000 or 35,000. Know, people can go into the internet and check all I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so those 25,000 people, of course, are in love with Chavez. And those 25 people are the ones that when you go to Venezuela, Chavez introduces you to.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, you know what I'm going to be? Am I explaining myself?
Oh, you're doing a great job. I mean, obviously, Sean Penn is getting a very limited view of Venezuela,
yes.
And it's what Hugo Chavez wants him to see. The other thing is, too, I mean, maybe I shouldn't have called him a hypocrite, but Sean Penn has enjoyed everything that capitalism has to offer.
Yes.
Now he criticizes it.
You know, I believe there are two classes of capitalism, okay? The good ones and the bad ones. The bad ones, the good ones are people, you know, like me. I like to be a capitalist.
Mm-hmm.
I like to live well. I like to work hard. I don't steal from anybody. So if I work hard, why can't I live the life that I want? The bad capitalists, you know, the bad capitalists are the ones that step on people, that abuse people, that use people. They're the ones that give, you know, capitalism a bad name, like Bon Jovi could say, you know.
Yeah.
But and the communists, even the worst capitalists of the world, because they preach to the people something that all that is bad, but then they are the ones that have all the power and all the money and the big Rolexes and they say this country is horrible, you know, and they have apartments in Fifth Avenue.
Right.
And you know what I mean? So that's what I don't respect, you know?
Oh, I understand. It's kind of like Al Gore. I mean, the guy preaches about global warming, but he's got a big houseboat. He's got a huge house, a mansion that takes 10 times the electricity of everyone else. He doesn't turn his lights off on Earth Day. He flies around the world in a private jet. I mean, it's the exact same thing. I mean, he pushes against CO2 emissions, but he emits more CO2 than anybody I know. So it's the same thing with these left-wingers. They have two sets of rules, one set of rules for them and one set of rules for everybody else.
Yes, yes. That's sadly the way it is, you know. I mean, I really don't like politics. It's like so confusing. And you know, and there's good and bad in politicians, and
right.
It's just very, you know, it's very complicated to know who to believe. And for most people, you know, for the majority of the normal, you know, normal quote unquote, you know, we are normals, but you know, it's just man, it just breaks my heart just to see children being indoctrinated since they're babies in public schools in Cuba and in Venezuela. They're growing up with hate. And, you know, towards those that could be maybe a little bit whiter, or towards those who live well because of hard work. And, you know, it's just they learn to insult. You should see my Twitter. I mean, my Twitter is like, oh, my God. My Twitter, is, by the way, is at MC lower the line. How do you call that?
Underscore?
Underscore, yeah.
Yeah.
Being in capitals, MC underscore Alonso with an S. Anyway, you know, like 10% of them insult me like you can't imagine. I will hope you die. You're a pig. You're
wow.
A fascist. I mean, that's what Chavez has taught them, because that's the way he talks. But then, you know, that 90% is in favor of me and insults them. And I'm like, no, don't go back and forth insulting. Let them insult only, you know. I regret calling, you know, Sean the deep hole thing, you know, but and so that's the way they grow up, with hate inside of them, you know, and with love to this man that really of Chavez, yes, I can say, and Fidel Castro and Raul, who's worse than Fidel. With for them, I do say that they're hypocrites and they're cynical people and they're egocentric, totalitarian, communist. And every other word in the dictionary that is not written because it's bad.
Well, if you could say something to Sean Penn right now, assume you're talking to him and not me, regarding the desire to get together, what would you say to Sean Penn right now if you could communicate with him directly?
I would say, Sean, how would you like for you to be working all your life and someone comes and takes away your house, because there are people on the street that have no way to live, so you know they need to live there. How do you feel if you know your someone in your family is dying or is in need of medicine, and you can't find it anywhere, and someone has to send it from, you know, from another country, and maybe that person dies. How do you feel if you work all your life, you're middle class, and you work all your life, and you have a little, you know, tiny supermarket or a, you know, boutique, a little store, and the government comes and says, expropriate it, you know, which is what they do. They say they have been expropriating buildings and farms and land. You know, if you have an apartment on the beach besides your everyday house, oh, no, you can't do that. I said, how do you feel after working all your life, after having your money in your bank? How would you feel if they come and take it away from you? People have committed suicide because of that. How do you feel if you want to go, if you want to travel out of the country? Well, in Cuba, you're not allowed to travel. The government has to give you permission to travel, okay?
Yeah.
In Venezuela, the government doesn't really have to give you permission, but if your passport, it's, you know, if you have to renew your passport, it can take months and months and months, and your money, you cannot, unless it's, you know, it's underground or whatever, but legally, you know, you cannot take out more than $400 a year out of your account when you travel, and you can use in the credit card up to $700 just for the hotels and restaurants. This I found out exact, because before it used to be, I think, $5,000 a year, then it became $1,500. But last night I was at this dinner when we're talking about this issue, and I wrote a friend of mine, a BB, you know, BlackBerry Messenger, BB, and I asked her, I said, you know, what is it again? Because she's in the politics, and then she's the one that told. So that's why I exactly know from last night that this is what now is happening. I mean, who are they to tell you what to do with your money? You know, it's with your life, with your ideas. You know, it's like, how would he like to have his kids in school, in public school, and be taught that Israel is horrible? You know, Sean is half Jewish. You know, that we're going to kill them all. We're going to throw them to the sharks, which is what Chavez says and people said. And people can go into the internet and type down Chavez throws, you know, one said, you know, showing the, you know, Jewish people to the seas to be eaten by, or something like that. You will find all these things on the internet.
I'm with you. Sean Penn does not seem like a stupid person, and why he hasn't researched this better is beyond me. Now, let me ask you this. I know you said you don't like politics, so I'm sure you don't want to have a label on you as far as Democrat, Republican, whatever. But when you are socializing with other Hollywood stars like yourself, do you feel the need to keep quiet about your views because all of Hollywood is so liberal?
No, really. You know, I have friends from both. I'm really an independent. I like things from both parties. Okay. Mm-hmm. I like people from both parties, and I don't like people from both parties. It's like everything in life, you know. But I do talk up. I mean, I go to Republican parties, and I go to Democrat party. But no matter where I'm at, I speak up. You know, I mean. I grew up with this. I was born in Cuba, so I was taught not to be afraid to speak up about your beliefs, especially when it's something that we've lived. When I've had friends that have been in jail in Bay of Pigs. I have friends that knew Che Guevara, who is an assassin and has been portrayed by the media and their propaganda as the amazing, wonderful man, you know. So I do speak the truth, even though if it hurts me, which I think it has a little bit, because, you know, some people are allowed to talk, but others not.
Mm-hmm.
But I just feel great. I mean, you know, I do. I think that as long as I speak the truth, even if that doesn't bring work for me, which I hope I can continue working as an actress and a singer for as long as I want, and this doesn't really get in the way. But I know that's something that can happen and could happen and might have happened, you know, but I can't shut up, you know. I mean, I am working right, you know, I'm working right now with this script called Courage. I'm saying it now in your radio station, so to see if anybody can reach out and find out about it. Courage is it's a story about what's going on in Venezuela since Chavez has been there. It's a story about two couples, one of my generation and one and our daughter, who we are like a Jewish Venezuelan rich money people. Our daughter falls in love with communist, Chavez, young guy who idolizes Che Guevara, and and he is called Che. So this movie has been, I mean, it's amazing. I've been talking to different, you know, people, to different producers. I still don't have it, you know, all of it to start doing it. But we talk about the Hezbollah. We talk about, you know, Ahmadinejad. We talk about, of course, the Castros and the Mossad, the FARC, which, you know, Chavez is a big believer, and he helps money-wise, the FARC, ETA. I mean, we mentioned all this, and it's an amazing movie about love, about, I'm Rambo, kind of like, you know. It takes place in Washington, D.C., in Venezuela, and in Israel and Colombia. It's an amazing script. The guy who wrote it, his name is Michael Rowan, R-O-W-A-N. He's written a couple of books. Of course, speaking the truth. And he used to be, years ago, a consultant here in the States. He was a consultant for Jimmy Carter, and I can't remember which other Democrat president. Then he's now an independent, and he's now on our side regarding, you know, Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro and all these communists, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he lived in Venezuela, and when his life, and he married a Venezuelan. And he had a son in Venezuela, and he used to write over there for a newspaper. When their lives started to get threatened, they have to move. They have to they have to leave the country. And so we have this amazing story that we've been, you know, creating for like 2 years or mm-hmm. 3 years, and finally he wrote. You know, it's not a script that we're going to need a Hollywood script writer for it, but it is kind of like script in the sense of it says, you know, scene one, and it gives all the details. There are also dialogues between everybody. I mean, it's such an amazing, amazing, amazing story that is going to be made. I mean, I've been trying to have this made for the past 3 years, and I know it's going to, and I hope that this helps that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I do hope.
Now, is it based on a book by Michael Rowan, or is...
No, he's gonna make a book out of this. No, we've been talking and talking and talking about all this. He knows absolutely everything because he's done his homework as a journalist. I know a lot of things as well because, you see, I put my career aside for a few years because all I did was concentrate on spreading the word around. This was before Chavez won. I already knew who he was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to do a coup d'etat in 1992, and I was there that day. I lived that. The mm-hmm. tanks going out on the streets, the bombs. I mean, So this is a fictional story made out of true events, okay? And he's going to make a book out of it. And now I'm meeting with different screenwriters from Hollywood that believe in that too, to make it into a script. It's going to be extremely easy now because it is almost a script, but it's 200 pages long or 300 pages long. So now it has to be made into a Hollywood story.
Mm-hmm.
But as I'm repeating myself, the dialogues are there. The descriptions of everything, you know, morning, dawn, coming in, it's all there. And it's going to say a lot. It's going to really, you know, show the bad Chavistas, but we show a couple of them that are not bad, but believed really in a revolution to help, and slowly are realizing that they've been lied to. you know, because we have to show both points of view, the ones that really are deep holes and the ones that believe in it.
Sorry.
You know?
I think it's cute the way you're saying that. We're taping right now. This is pre-recorded. So whenever I put it on the air, do you want me to actually put a beep where you say beep?
Oh, whatever you want. I mean, I can say the word asshole.
Very good. That's what I was looking for.
Right.
And then I'll beep it. I have to say, something while I'm talking to you keeps popping into my head. See if you remember this story. A long time ago, you were on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And I don't know what he said to you, but apparently whatever it was making you hot. But you didn't want to say hot on the air, so you whispered into Johnny's ear, you know, I'm getting hot, this is making me hot, but I can read your lips. So then Johnny goes and he whispers it into the ear of Doc Severinsen. Doc Severinsen whispers into the ear of Tommy Newsom, and then they whisper it all the way through the band.
Oh, my gosh. I remember that. It was so funny.
It was. I was laughing so hard my side was hurting when they did that.
That was very funny. I remember that. Oh, my gosh. It was memories.
Maria, I think I've got an idea that might bring closure to this situation. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to call Sean Penn's agent, and I'm going to tell them that you said that if he would come on this show, the two of you could have a nice, polite conversation about Hugo Chavez and Castro and Che, and it would be very polite, very respectful, no calling people assholes, and no calling
and
people...
And you can tell her PR or his PR that I told you that I was sorry that I called him an asshole, you know?
I promise
the truth.
I will.
And
also, what was I going to say? By the way, I think what he meant, I've been thinking about this, and I don't mean to flatter you, but I've always felt that you're very, very beautiful. And for someone like Sean Penn to say, you pig, I think he meant it within the context of capitalist pig.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, that's
oh,
it. Because
I'm,
people,
yeah,
because
completely.
You see people on the internet, they're going, how could he call this beautiful woman a pig? How could he be so blind? And I was thinking he didn't mean
no.
it negative. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I am completely, in sync with that. But the funny thing is that is what he also is.
Yeah.
A capitalist.
Well, of course he is, and he takes advantage of it, and then he criticizes it. That's what's so ironic about all of these people.
Know.
You know, Michael Moore goes down to Occupy Wall Street and bashes capitalism, even though capitalism has made him what he is.
I know.
Horrible.
I can't stand Michael Moore.
Well, you know, Michael Moore, it's so funny because whenever the whole thing happened in Wisconsin with Governor Scott Walker, with the union people, Michael Moore was there talking about supporting the working man and working woman. But he gets most of his post-production work for his movies done outside of the country. As much as possible, he shoots the scenes outside of the country because he doesn't want to have to pay the high union wages in America. So he claims to be for the unions, but he gets as much work as possible done outside the United States to avoid the unions. So once again, I think he's a communist hypocrite, you know, or a capitalist.
Well, he's a bad capitalist. That's a bad capitalist. And it's funny because I was thinking about somewhere I should say, you give capitalism a bad name, you know, like Jumbo Jolly, you know.
Okay. Well, hopefully if he comes back on the air, you can tell him that only very nicely. I do see him as being very shy. I don't think he's going to come on, but I'm going to try for you. I think we have a better shot of finding you a screenwriter than we do getting Sean Penn to come on the air. I don't know. I've always gotten strange vibes off of Sean Penn. He seems like a total recluse. I'm glad he was nice to work with when you did Colors Together.
Yes. It was very nice. Thank God, you know?
Absolutely. Well, Maria, unless you have anything else to add to this, I'm going to go ahead and start editing and get this on the air. So.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. Let me know what's in the air so I can put it on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
You have a
cool.
Very Merry Christmas, Maria.
Merry Christmas to you, too. Thank you so much. It's great talking
you.
To you.
I feel like I've made a friend. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks to you, Mike. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Don't go away. When we come back, we're going to have Laura Schroff and Maurice Mazak to tell us the incredible story behind the book An Invisible Thread. It's the story of an 11-year-old panhandler and a busy New York advertising executive who somehow crossed paths on the streets of New York. After that encounter, neither of their lives was ever the same, nor were the lives of any of their friends and family ever the same. Easily the feel-good book of this holiday season. You will not want to miss this interview.
Are you worried about the economy? Have you ever wondered if the politicians and the bankers are going to bring the whole thing crashing down? If so, pay close attention. Because in an economic meltdown, non-hybrid seeds could become more valuable than even silver and gold. After all, securing a source of food for your family is the single most important thing you can do. Introducing the Survival Seed Bank, the perfect mix of germination-tested non-hybrid seeds. You get enough seeds to plant a full-acre crisis garden that can produce an endless supply of nutrient-dense food for you and your family. And the best part is that these seeds have not been genetically modified in any way. Remember, in a real economic crisis, non-hybrid seeds are the ultimate barter item. Prepare your family today.
Welcome back to the Tea Party Power Hour. I want to remind everyone that if you'd like to learn more about how you can have your own survival seed bank, go to teapartypowerhour.com and check out the ad at the bottom of the page. While you're there, you may want to check out ads for solar-powered ovens and solar-powered generators, all items that can help your family stay prepared for hurricanes, tornadoes, and winter storms. Remember, once the storm hits, it's too late to get prepared. Now, as promised in the second half of the show, we're going to be visiting with Laura Schroff, Maurice Mazak, and Alex, help me out with the name.
Trezniowski.
Very good. They're here to talk to us about a wonderful new book entitled An Invisible Thread. Guys, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having us. We're delighted.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for having us, Mark.
Certainly. This is one of those feel-good books that's out just in time for Christmas. The timing couldn't be more perfect. Laura, it's your book. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, the book came out November 1st, and we're very excited about it. In fact, a week later, it hit the New York Times bestseller list. But it's really about an unlikely friendship between Maurice and I when we met back in 1986.
Well, so you're walking down the street, you're a busy ad executive, and this little kid comes up to you. What happens next?
And he looks at me and he says to me, "Excuse me, lady," he said, "I'm really hungry. Do you have any spare change?" And I said no, and I walked away.
But
as I, and as I walked away, though, I realized what he said, and I went back and told him that I didn't want to give him any spare change, but I would take him to lunch over at McDonald's.
So, Maurice, what were you thinking at that point?
Well, Mark, I was thinking that this was great. I was very hungry that day. I still can remember that day. I was very hungry, and Laura came over. She was a godsend, and she helped me out tremendously that day and throughout the rest of my life.
Wow. So at what point, Laura, did you realize when you – well, wait a minute. Help me out. You go to McDonald's and you buy him some food, and I guess you decide to sit there with him while he's enjoying the food, or what happens next?
Yeah, I actually asked him if I could join him. So we started to chat, and what I remember so distinctly was that he had the warmest eyes. And we started to chat. He asked me where I lived, and I told him I lived across the street. And I found out that he lived at the Bryan Hotel. And back really in the 1980s, there were quite a few welfare hotels throughout New York City, but the Bryan was one of probably the worst welfare hotels in New York City. What was amazing is that he lived on 54th Street, and I lived on 56th. So really, there was only one street that divided our two very different worlds.
Wow. And how is it that you two chanced to connect after that day?
I ended up bumping into him again on Thursday night. I really, for the entire week, couldn't get him out of my mind. And that particular Thursday night, he was really hungry again, and he decided to go to the same corner. So I saw him, and I took him to McDonald's, and when we were done, I said, "I've got a great idea." I said, "Why don't you meet me on the corner next Monday night? I'll take you out to dinner." And we did, and that was the beginning of 4 years of consecutive Mondays of getting together, and we continued to maintain our friendship throughout the 25 years that we've known each other.
My goodness. Now, Maurice, what are you thinking? You were just looking for change that day, but here you found this wonderful person that was willing to meet with you on a regular basis and make sure you had something to eat.
At the time, I was thinking that I was wondering, what did she want as far as taking time out of her life and meeting with me and nurturing me and caring for me. And about the fifth visit, I found out that all she wanted was, you know, a friend. And I was great. It was great to have a great friend such as Laura at the time, because being 11 and being looked over most of your life, it was nice to have an adult pay attention to you.
Gotcha. Now, what was your situation? You said it was nice to have an adult pay attention to you. Did you not have a mother or a father looking after you at that point?
Well, I had a mother looking after me, but my mother was, you know, she was on drugs. So, and my father, he had left when I was like 5 years old. Mm. But the fact that my mom was on drugs and she really couldn't take care of me the way she wanted or the way she needed to, mm-hmm. I was basically on my own, and I really didn't have any adult supervision back then at 11. And Laura stepped in and she paid attention. She loved me. She cared for me. And it was much needed at the time, because it changed my life and my perspective on life to this day.
Maurice, were you going to school at this time?
Yeah. Yes,
okay.
I was going to school, but I was going to school sporadically. I was going when I wanted to go. Like I said, I had no adult supervision. And mainly, I just went to school to eat.
That's what I was going to ask. Were you getting something to eat at school?
Yeah, that was one of the only reasons why I went to school.
Yeah, this is bizarre, but you're all grown up, but I'm still worried about the little Maurice as to whether or not he was eating. Now, Laura, you said this went on for about 4 years?
Yes, uh-huh.
And tell me how it progressed, because obviously as it went forward, there was more to this than just taking little Maurice to lunch or to dinner.
Well, as Maurice said about the fifth visit, I invited him to my home to make him dinner, and he was really a little bit worried. He didn't really understand why I was inviting him to my home. And we had one serious conversation. I said to him, you know, the reason why I've invited you to my home is because I consider you a friend. I said, and friendship is built on trust. I said, so I want to make it really clear to you. I said, if anything's ever missing from my apartment, we're no longer going to be friends. And he looked at me and with this puzzled look, and he said to me, you just want to be my friend? So I said, well, yes. I said, of course. And he stood up, he put his hand out, and he said, a deal is a deal. So we started with Monday night rituals, which were very simple. You
uh-huh.
know, I taught him how to set a table. He asked me one night if I could show him how to use a fork and knife. We baked chocolate chip cookies, which he loved. He loved bringing the garbage out. As time went on, he brought over his dirty laundry. We would do homework together. We would play games together. And we would just spend Monday nights together with just simple rituals. And for me, I also came from a very chaotic home. So I knew that I could not change my past. But I had this incredible opportunity to be able to hopefully change Maurice's future. And what I really wanted to do was bring to him the structure in his life that I didn't have as a child. So while I was helping him out, he was helping me out. And we were both learning from each other, which was really amazing.
That certainly is amazing on so many levels. And by the way, Maurice, don't feel bad for being suspicious. If Laura had tried to bring me dinner every single Monday night and invite me to her home, I would have been suspicious too. I think we live in a world where kindness doesn't occur as often as it should. So I can only imagine you were probably wondering, you know, does someone like this really even exist?
Right, right. Even the book tells stories about, you know, adults that had taken advantage of me, such as Snake the Pimp. and others. So that's why I was kind of suspicious of Laura, and rightfully so.
Yeah, I think it's it was a natural reaction. And Laura, did you find yourself, could you feel yourself gradually gaining Maurice's trust?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because from the very beginning, most of my friends and my family were really, really concerned about me. But I just remember looking at him at McDonald's, and I thought he had the most trusting eyes. I just really believed that he was a good kid that was stuck in a really hard life. So I never not trusted him, but I just needed to clarify and set some parameters. And I never worried about it. I mean, as time went on, he would come over to my apartment on Saturdays and just hang out. And he was really fascinated that I had this jug of quarters, and we talk about it in the book. And he couldn't imagine how you could have extra money to be able to have a jug of quarters that you didn't use. But yet I knew when I left him in my apartment, I never had to worry that he was going to touch my quarters. Mm-hmm. What he loved about being in my apartment was the opportunity to be able to go into the refrigerator, open up the refrigerator, take out something to eat, watch TV, and just have some really peaceful time to himself, which was something he didn't have. I mean, Maurice lived in a room that was 12 by 12. It had two single beds with no bedding, one chair, a half a refrigerator, and a TV. And he lived in this room with his mother, his grandmother, his two sisters, an aunt, two baby cousins, an uncle, and then three other uncles that kind of came in and out. So you can just imagine the kind of chaos that he was living in.
It's hard to imagine.
It is hard.
To be quite frank, I mean, it's amazing because, you know, I think a lot of us like to talk about how hard we had it as a kid, you know, and I'm telling my son's stories like, well, we lived in a small apartment and, you know, our television, get this, son, our television was black and white, no color television. And you know, you tell this story and it's like, wow, what am I whining about? Maurice, did she peg it pretty closely? I mean, it was just a chance for you to sort of relax in a sense because you weren't jam-packed in with a whole lot of other people?
Yeah, it was my getaway time. It was the time that I can relax and sit. And for the first time in my long 11 years, I got to think, you know, and I never really had a chance to think. And with Laura, I dared to dream, and I dreamed of a future that I now have today. You know, today I'm a husband, I'm a father, I own my own company. I've done pretty well, and I'm pretty well off right now. So, yeah, she helped me to dream, and that was the time I had to dream. And without that time, I would have not dreamed, and I would have succumbed. To my immediate future at that time, and that was to be a drug dealer.
Wow. And I'm wondering what the response was at school, because I'm guessing that the more you came in contact with Laura and the more she helped you with your homework and so forth, the more you started attending school and the better you started performing academically?
Yeah, I had gotten a lot better in school, and one teacher in particular noticed everything that was going on, and her name was Miss House. She's in the book, and Laura had an encounter with her, and she had said some things to Laura, and Laura can explain that a little bit better.
I met with Miss House, and one of the reasons why I wanted to meet with her was because I wanted to also set up some kind of organization where they could see that Maurice was making progress and that I was making a difference in his life. And you know, Miss House was an enormously caring teacher. She knew that Maurice came from a really tough life, but she didn't know to what degree. And so she was very happy all of a sudden to see that there was an adult in Maurice's life that was having a positive effect on him. And Maurice was quite the little fighter when he was a little boy. I mean, And all of a sudden, she noticed that he stopped finally having fights all the time. He was more content in his life. And Maurice can talk about that a little bit, too.
Yeah, I basically just went to school, ate lunch, and fought all day. I spent a lot of time in the principal's office for fighting. And, you know, when I met Laura, she taught me, you know, physical strength is temporary, but mental strength lasts a lifetime. And I learned that lesson, you know, even to this day. I try to think things out, talk things out, before resulting to anything other than, you know, using the more positive and effective way of living.
You know, that is a lesson that can carry over into so many areas, Maurice. I mean, right now we're living in very tough economic times, and, you know, we've got the issues going on with flash mobs out there. You know, there was violence at the Occupy Wall Street movements in some areas, and I think it's important to note that Americans are scared right now, and sometimes that's the reaction people have is when they're scared is they get very combative. I heard a statistic a few days ago that this past, the day after Thanksgiving, was like one of the biggest sales days for guns, you know, in the history of people buying guns for Christmas, because so many people out there are scared. And, you know, here's a chance to learn a lesson from you about how violence, you know, it should never be the first resort. And, I mean, this thing just goes way, way beyond even, you know, what it was originally, I don't want to say meant to be, but, you know, the original message that one might take from it. I think it carries over not only to one-on-one personal interactions, but the way our society is so tense right now. And really, I mean, wouldn't it be great if countries could think that way too? There wouldn't be a need for any wars, man. I mean, that's just a beautiful message. Thank you for sharing it.
Thank you.
You know, it's interesting, Mark, when you're saying how, you know, times are really tough today. What we're really kind of hoping people will take from our book is that they'll see that a simple gesture can make an enormous difference. And, you know, people don't have to save the world. There was an email that I received just recently from a gentleman who lives in Arizona, and he read the book and was really very, very much moved by it. And he was in a grocery store just the other day, and a young woman with two small children were in front of him, and her bags were, her groceries were bagged, and she went to give the debit card, and it was declined. He said, and I thought about your book. He said, and I thought that I didn't have to save world hunger. He said, but I could do something really nice. He said, and what I decided to do was pay for her groceries. You know, Maurice and I, our relationship was not an accident. I absolutely believe that, you know, the name of our book, An Invisible Thread, does connect those that are destined to meet, and we were destined to meet. But I think that there are so many people, if they were to take the time and look at themselves and look what's around them, they would see that there's an invisible thread, like, right there in front of their eyes. It's an unplanned blessing that sometimes you don't take the time to even notice.
You know, so many memories, so many emotions, you know, are kind of gushing forward as I hear you guys tell this story. I mean, I remember the movie that came out, Pay It Forward. And I think so many of us get caught up in our busy lives. And here you are. And we kind of use that as an excuse to walk past people. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. I've stopped and given people money before. But at the same time, I've walked past people who were asking for money, albeit, as you found out, it's a little tough to do it to a kid. But, you know, especially in areas that are known for this type of thing where there's, you know, numerous people asking you for money. And, you know, you hear this story and you're thinking, wow, you know, maybe I could make a small difference that turns into a big difference. Now, Maurice, when did you realize that this thing was going to, you know, not just be something that went on while you were in school, but that you were going to know Laura for a lifetime?
I would say it was about the fifth meeting when we shook hands and I said a deal is a deal.
Wow.
I thought at that point that I had found that God has given me the mother that I so rightly deserved. Laura always wanted children, and bless her, she never, you know, conceived naturally. But spiritually and physically, I am here, and I am her son. And I knew at that point that I would never steal from her, and I would never betray her trust, and we would be together for the rest of our lives.
Now, how is what you've learned from Laura carried on in your own personal life with your own spouse and your own children?
Well, basically, how what I've learned from Laura has changed my life. It has broken the cycle of, you know, drugs, violence, lack of education, you know, homelessness, poverty, and just it's like my life was so abnormal and so disadvantaged. Right now, my kids, you know, and my wife and we're at a normal pace at this point, but we were I was so dysfunctional that I thought that was normal. You know, I thought being a drug dealer was normal. I thought not working was normal. And now my children aspire to be something, and they dream from day one something that I didn't do.
You know, it's interesting, Mark. You know, Maurice talks about dreaming. I would say probably about the eighth visit, we decided to go out to Long Island to visit with my sister. And my sister, you know, lives in suburbia. She had, you know, a house with grass. Maurice had never stepped foot in a house and had never been really on grass. He was a city kid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he played the entire day with my sister's children. And then we had dinner that evening in her dining room. And Maurice was fascinated by the fact that you could have a room where you just had special meals.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were driving home, I said to him, by the way, tell me about what was your favorite part of the day. And I really expected that he would say he loved going for a bike ride with Derek or playing basketball or playing on the swings. And it was the first time I realized he was starting to dream and that he was making it, that our friendship was making a difference. He said to me, you know, Miss Laura, he said, someday, he said, when I grow up, he said, I want to have a big dining room table just like your sister Annette, so we can sit around the table and we can all talk like a family. And when you go into Maurice's house, he has a big dining room table.
So the dream came true.
Yeah.
That's a great story. You know, the other thing is, you're talking about breaking that cycle of poverty and violence and drugs. I mean, there are so many people who I think have given up hope, both the people that are living in that situation and people who are looking at it from the outside. You know, they're saying, well, you know, a lot of these families, this has been going on for several generations. This is pretty much a lost cause. There's nothing you can do. You can't save the world. And here is a case where someone just spending a little time with a little boy broke that cycle, you know, very, very quickly. And, I mean, you multiply that out and you think about just how this one example could change the world if more people were like Laura.
Definitely. And I look at it more like, wow, Laura came into my life when I was 11. I was very impressionable. I could have went either way, and I chose a path that led me to a better life. And I say prosperity. I'm not rich, but prosperity is love, kindness, and caring. And these things for me is priceless. And what Laura has done is not only does she break the cycle in my life, but the book talks about uncles and my mom and my grandma, and these people have been on drugs for years.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're cleaning up their lives, and three of my uncles work for me. So she not only helped me out, and she not only helped my children out, but in her teaching me, and me leading by example for my family has even shown them that they can come out of poverty and they can come out of a situation where they were doomed also. So it basically helped a whole family and a whole generation and generations to come.
You know, Maurice's mother and her grandmother were very skeptical of me in the beginning, even though they didn't realize, I only met them once. But Maurice's mother was finally clean, you know, when she died. And Maurice's grandmother used to call me his little white angel before she passed away. So our relationship did even change their perspective as far as, you know, being not as color conscious.
I think that's an important deal. I actually taught at a youth camp for underprivileged kids one summer while I was still a student at Texas A&M. And it was so funny because we had about 42 kids. There were 8 of us who were counselors that were all students. And it was amazing. You know, a lot of these kids had never seen a swimming pool before and all of this type of thing. And I remember one day we decided to take the kids to the beach, and many of the kids had never seen a beach before either. And, it was actually a beach on a lake, not a beach at the ocean. But the bottom line is that I ended up losing one of the kids temporarily.
Oh, God.
And so I had 8 of them attached to me. I ran to one of the security guys, and I said, I've lost one of my kids. You got to help me. And he said, okay, describe him to me. And so I was going, well, he's about this tall, and he's got short hair, and he's kind of got pudgy little cheeks, and, you know, okay. And then he walked away, and I said, wait a minute, he's African-American. And the guy looked back at me, and like, are you nuts? That should have been the first thing you should have said. And it was kind of funny how there were, you know, 40, I guess there were 50 of us at that camp, 42 kids, 8 counselors, and then I guess some director. But by the end of the summer, you know, we really, really were colorblind between, you know, Caucasian, Hispanic, African-American. And my God, what a great thing. You know, when something like that happens, where suddenly, you know, you totally just wipe that as an issue off the table. And it's just, I love you guys. And again, you guys are just causing all kind of memories to come forward. I'm getting goosebumps here.
Thank you.
In fact, the timing of this book couldn't be better. We've got a couple of minutes left. One of you tell the listeners how they can get a hold of a copy of this book, and then let me know what I need to do to throw some stuff up on our website, to make sure people know how to get in touch with you.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. Basically, the book is being sold, of course, in Barnes & Noble across the country, as well as Amazon and barnesandnoble.com. We also have our own website, www.aninvisiblethread.com, and you can actually, there's a link there where you can buy the book as well. And we also have an opportunity where if people want to share their own invisible story on our website, we love receiving emails.
Oh, okay. And there's just there's one of those email boxes where you just hit contact or something and that comes up, or is there an email address we can give out right now?
It's all on the website. You can just, okay. There's a, under contact, and you can just hit the contact, and I'm really making an effort to address every single email that we're receiving. So we love hearing from people, and we love getting invisible thread stories because we know there's so many wonderful, beautiful stories out there, and
yeah,
we love to share them.
And those stories are much needed in a time like this where, you know, we are at a downfall in the economy, and mm-hmm. people need to hear inspirational things right now. So it's important that, you know, listeners write to our website and share their stories.
Well, thank you for that, Maurice, and I couldn't agree with you more. I just think that if there's one Christmas where this book, you know, needed to come out, It's Christmas of 2011. There are a lot of people out there out of work who need help. There are, you know, so many people who are just tense about, you know, some of the violence and some of the things that are going on out there. And, you know, I got to tell you, I'm personally, you know, in a situation where things can be financially tough at times. And I got to tell you that you're always tense about, well, what if this happens and what if that happens? And then all of a sudden there's just this wonderful feel-good story and it kind of washes over your body from head to toe. And then, you know, all of a sudden you just kind of feel like, hey, I've got, you know, I've got my health, everything is great and life is good. And I got to tell you, I'm never going to complain about having just simply black and white TV when I was a kid again.
Thank you.
Oh, wow. Listen, will you guys come back and talk with me again?
We would love to, Mark. This is an absolutely wonderful, wonderful interview, and we so much appreciate the fact that you would spend, you know, a half hour with us, and we'd be thrilled to. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, I'll connect through your publicist. I'm sure it'll be next year, so let me just tell you guys before we let you go, Merry Christmas to all of you, and God bless you for sharing this story.
And Merry Christmas to you, and God bless you and your listeners as well. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having
us,
Mark.
Thank
you very much. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Same here, Maurice. It was very nice meeting you. That's all we have time for today on the Tea Party Power Hour. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Remember to catch us next week when we'll be interviewing James Dellingpole, the author of a new book about the environmental movement called Watermelon. And we're also going to try to have Catherine Cryer on, the author of a new book called Patriots Act. So we look forward to having you join us for those interviews as well. And before we go, I just want to thank my listeners for a very special 2011. I want to wish everyone out there a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Make no mistake about it, 2012 will be the year that we take this country back. Merry Christmas, everybody.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.